It's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Albert Fredriksen. I'm going to read off a very impressive list of accolades here. So, Professor Fredriksen is a professor of European law at the University of Bergen in Norway, and he holds several degrees. Most importantly, at the part German, he holds a degree from the University of Göttingen.
I'm very happy to take it out. I'm going to ignore the other degrees that are
at relevant. I didn't notice that because he has two doctorates, then that would make you doctor, or professor, doctor, which the German he also loves. And then Urban Fischen would also say he's a member of the Norwegian Academy of Arts, Sciences and Letters, co-director of the Bergen Center for the Europeanization of Norwegian Law, editor in chief of the Norwegian Law Journal, and a member of the 2022-24 review committee, EEA review committee that assess Norway's current affiliation to the European Union. Good. And with that, also from my side, thank you very much for being here. And it is wonderful also that this is sort of the beginning of a longer stay, which is will be until just the end of March. So in case the Q&As go on and on, don't worry, there's several weeks. Right. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction and thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here. From a very selfish perspective, Brexit has increased the interest both in the UK and the EU for the perspectives of the remaining EFTA states on their relations with the European Union, which is good for us. It's perhaps the only good thing that came out of Brexit. My plan today is to offer a very brief introduction to what is sometimes referred to as the Norway model, although it's neither exclusively Norwegian nor really a model in the proper sense of that word. I shall then try to explain why external developments and the EU's attempts to protect its internal market causes problems for this Norway model. A key question, as indicated on my very first slide, is whether it is possible in today's world to remain fully integrated in the internal market without joining the customs union. That is a problem we are currently discussing in the EFTA pillar. So this is the outline, briefly. Norway as a reluctant European, the Norway model, problem caused by this rethink of the internal market. I will mention a few legal acts under discussion, safeguard measures, and then whether it is possible to join the customs union. I have to start just briefly with Norway as a reluctant European. Norway has, my country, has always been very skeptical towards European integration. This is due to a complex mix of historical, geographical, economic, and cultural reasons. I would love to discuss those with you, but it will only have to mention them briefly here. Union with Sweden and Denmark, fisheries, agriculture. There are lots of specific reasons why Norway has always been very reluctant. One of those reasons is Norway's very close relationship to the UK. So Norway was a founding member of EFTA, the European Free Trade Association, in 1960. That was founded on the initiative of the UK. And when the UK applied for membership of the EEC in 1962 and again in 1967, Norway sort of felt that we had to follow, but with little enthusiasm. And when French President de Gaulle vetoed the UK applications, then the Norwegians' applications were also immediately withdrawn. Then the UK, as you know, applied again in 1972, and again Norway and Denmark felt that we had to follow. And this time it came all the way to a referendum. I have a picture there. You can see how close it was. But the no camp won. It was a very bitter and a hard-fought debate, and ended with a no. Then, a bit later, in 1992, the EEA agreement was found as sort of the way to access the market without having to subscribe to the ever-closer union. So it was considered a good solution, a good compromise. But as you know, in the same year, the other EFTA states, again outside the control of Norway, the other EFTA states seized the opportunity after the end of the Cold War, Finland, Sweden, Austria in particular, to apply for membership of the European Union. And it was impossible for Norway not to follow suit. But again, the voters were skeptical, and the result was again a no in the second Norwegian referendum. Also close, but not that close. I think it was 52% in the vote. Yeah. So this is the background, and this is important to understand. I come from a Eurosceptic country. The Norway model is then the national compromise. And the centerpiece is this already mentioned EEA agreement from 1992. This was retained after 1994, even though most of the EFTA states left and joined the European Union. So there was not much left in the EFTA pillar. But Norway and Iceland were there, and Liechtenstein later joined. And that was just enough to maintain the agreement. I think three countries in the EFTA pillar is the minimum to make the institutions work, the court and so on. And the EU had accepted that, so the EEA agreement is much bigger and much grander than it would have been if it was negotiated today. And the EFTA states know that very well. That's part of the reason we don't touch it. It covers the better part of the internal market. So we don't only have access to the market, we are part of the internal market. The internal market is extended to cover the EFTA states. But there are really important carve-outs for fisheries and agriculture, very important to Norway and Iceland in particular. And it has proven to be a workable compromise also for the metallurgical industry, because it also covers steel, for instance. So the European Community for Steel and Coal was part of the negotiations in the 90s. That's quite important for Norway, where we have cheap green hydropower used to produce metal that is exported to the European market, steel, iron, aluminium, and so on. But then, over the years, over the last 30 years, this EEA agreement has been supplemented by more than 100 other agreements with the European Union. We have the Lugano Convention, so civil procedure. We have the Schengen Agreement, free movement of persons. We have the Dublin Agreement, asylum, European arrest warrant, and it just goes on and on and on. None of these agreements are formally linked to the EEA agreement. But it's obvious that many of them would never have been entered into without the EEA agreement as a centerpiece. So you can't cherry pick Schengen and Dublin and not have free movement of persons in the internal market. This is not very well understood in Norway. Many, many voters, many politicians think that these agreements are separate and you can sort of pick the ones you want to keep. That is obviously not the case. From the EU perspective, this is a model that has to be taken into seen as a whole. But of course, there are also some of the agreements are less related to the EA, like the agreements we have when it comes to fish. All of the agreements, I think it's right to say, all of the agreements has come about because the EFTA states are interested in new agreements. It's not the EU coming offering these agreements. It's always the EFTA states asking for further agreements. And we still ask for further agreements at the moment, particularly when it comes to the health union post-COVID. We're really concerned that a new pandemic will not be good. We should be integrated in the EU health union. The EU has been somewhat reluctant on that front, so these negotiations are not going so well, I think. Anyway, why has this Norway model worked? Well, this will be familiar to UK lawyers, I think. It has protected the constitutional red lines, at least on paper. So there is no automatic updating of the agreements. There is a right of veto. We can say no. There is no direct effect of adopted EU law in Norway. Interestingly enough, there is direct effective agreements in the EU legal order. So in this sense, there is a lack of reciprocity in the Norway model. Whether the EU would have accepted that today, we don't know. That's one of the reasons why we don't touch the agreement. And we have not accepted the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. But why does this still work? Well, because the EEA agreement has become too important to fail, too important to the EFTA states. So the importance has led to a highly pragmatic approach. So we have a right to veto, but we've never used it for 30 plus years. The effectiveness of EU rules, so no direct effect, but as long as we implement timely and we have a strong principle of conform interpretation, it hardly matters. We've been looking for this for 30 years and we've not been able to identify a single case from a Norwegian court where the lack of direct effect has been decisive for the outcome. Not one. And within the field of EEA law, so that centerpiece of the EEA model, there is additional remedies. We have a quasi primacy of implemented EU rules. We even have an unwritten principle of state liability, so Frankovic liability we have, and so on. And then, very important, de facto acceptance of the Court of Justice of the European Union as the authoritative interpreter of the rules by Norwegian courts and by the EFTA court. Otherwise, this wouldn't work. So we apply and follow case law from Strasbourg just as any other EU member state would do. But there are some worrying signs of wear and tear. The main part of the agreement still reflects the EC treaty as it stood in 1990. That is quite extraordinary. It is because we don't want to touch it. It was negotiated with 7 EFTA states and 12 EU EC member states. I think the assessment in Oslo in particular is that the 3 small remaining EFTA states would never be able to get such a good deal today as we got in 1990. So don't touch it. And there have been suggestions from myself and other that maybe we should just go for a technical update. So we try to keep the difficult political questions out and just update it. But we are very scared that this will be like opening Pandora's box. And therefore, the main part of the agreement is frozen. And then the annexes are continually updated. This creates a lot of really interesting questions that I feel sometimes very alone in the EFTA pillar. Because, I mean, the questions are so interesting that there should be many EU lawyers interested in it. How is this possible? We don't have the charter, we don't have the EEA citizenship, we don't have Article 2 on values, we don't have Article 6, we don't have Article 19, and still somehow this works. And the main reason for that is that the EFTA court has done very interesting, somewhat controversial, but very interesting job in sort of updating the agreement through its case law. And this is something that merits a lot of attention, how the EFTA court has been able to do that. But that would be for another seminar, I think. Further signs of problems is, well, what I have called the tsunami of EU secondary law. The joint committee where the EFTA states and the EU meets simply struggle to keep up with all the legal acts coming in. And there is a backlog that is worryingly long now, more than 600 legal acts the last time I checked. There are institutional problems, particularly related to what I have called the agencification of EU law, simply because these agencies don't fit into the two-pillar structure of the EEA, and they challenge Norway's red lights and those of Iceland. This necessitates adaptations, and that again delays the process considerably. So there are many, many EU legal acts that should be enforced in EEA, and they are not because of this. And the EFTA institutions, maybe they will disagree, but it's not, I don't think it is fair to say they struggle to keep up with the increasing complexity of EU internal market law. Think about the EFTA court, 3 judges trying to cover almost all kinds of cases that could end up before the Court of Justice with 54 judges in the General Court and 27 in the Court of Justice and more than 2,000 employees all together. That's difficult. And then there is also increasing political opposition in some fields, in particular related to the green transition and energy. For that reason, the Norwegian government has informed the EU that we're not able to implement the last energy package into the EA agreement. Proved impossible to convince or to get that through politically. Will be interesting to see how that develops. I would argue this is connected to the democratic deficit of the EA. They simply have no say when the rules are enacted, and that creates difficulties when they are considered quite controversial. Again, something we could elaborate further on. And then there is this, the Norway model, the fact that these agreements are not linked. There's not a joint institutional framework. And I will just give you one example. We had an interesting case before the EFTA court dealing with free movement of persons and COVID restrictions. And the EFTA court has only jurisdiction to deal with this under the EA agreement, free movement of persons, not the Schengen agreement, which is a bit strange. And at the same time, there was a case before the Court of Justice where, of course, Schengen and free movement of persons was considered together. The EFTA court sort of only had half of the tools available. They nevertheless followed the Info Nordic judgment from the Court of Justice, but it just demonstrates some of the difficulties. And now I'm coming slowly to my main point today. There are increasing difficulties related to packages of EU legislation that involve fields not covered by any of the agreements in the patchwork. And that is in particular legislation regulating access to the internal market for goods, services, and capital from third countries. I will come back to that. That is a main concern at the moment. And then in addition, we also have the problem with EU safeguard measures under VTO law. I will also mention that briefly. But first, I have to explain a little bit why we're not in the customs union. These pictures are not because I work for the tourist authorities in either of the EFTA states. This is Iceland, Liechtenstein, and Norway. But I think the pictures all show that if you're a farmer from one of these countries, it's pretty hard to compete with farmers from continental Europe. And also, as far as Norway and Iceland is concerned, fish is really, really, really important. So it was clear from the start when the EA agreement was negotiated that agriculture and fish should be kept out of the agreement. And when you keep agriculture and fish out of the agreement, it's difficult to join the customs union. It was decided to limit free movement of goods. And since we did not join the customs union, how to square that with free movement of goods? Well, you limit free movement of goods to goods originating within the EEA. And then you have very complex rules on origin. They are found in Protocol 4 of the agreement. I will not go into any of those details, but everybody who knows anything about international trade law knows this is complicated when it comes to these rules on origin. So the EFTA states could therefore continue to negotiate free trade agreements with third countries, and EFTA has, together in the EFTA camp, we have negotiated a large amount of free trade agreements, even more than the EU. This has worked fairly well, I would say, for 30 plus years. I'm not sure it would work for the UK. That's an open question, quite interesting. But it has worked for Iceland and Norway because what we export is generally fish, seafood, energy, and metal, aluminium and steel and so on. So because of these raw material-centered economies, the rules of origin is not that much of a problem. But if we were producing cars, it wouldn't work. Even though it has functioned fairly well, it has become more complicated. Brexit was a problem because it has made it much more difficult for Norway to export goods to the UK. I could give you one example. The Norwegian government for a while had this idea that Norway should be manufacturing batteries for EV, for electric vehicles, because we have a lot of hydropower, so clean energy, and then we should manufacture batteries. Problem is, if we export those to the UK, and the UK would want to export the car to Europe, it will be hit by tariffs, and the other way around, because the value of the battery of these cars is too high. So it would be considered important components coming from third countries, and the result would be with tariffs. So that's one of the reasons why we had to shelve that idea. So there is no at the moment no that project has been put aside. Anyway, geopolitics, I will come back to that. Trump and China has made this much more complicated. And then what I have called the strategic rethink of the internal market. And I will now come to that. I will not explain that much what it's about. These three reports you all know from 2024 and 2025, the Letta report, the Draghi report, and the Linisse report. I will not go into any details, but I think that the short version is that these all emphasize the importance of the internal market as perhaps the EU's greatest asset in today's geopolitical situation, and that the internal market needs to be protected and perhaps even used as leverage in negotiations with the US and with China. Why is that a problem for the EFTA states? Well, I think I should let the EFTA states say so themselves directly. This is a very important paper that was written by the EFTA states in 2024, directed to the EU. And I think it's worth, because this explains very well what the problem is about. The EFTA states note that the EU is increasingly addressing geopolitical challenges through internal market legislation. I think that is correct. And then, for that reason, several internal market-related initiatives also address issues such as trade, customs, and security, which are not within the scope of the EEA agreement. And that is the problem. And then here comes this strategic rethink phrase. It's imperative that a strategic rethink of the internal market takes into account the special relationship rooted in the EEA agreement. And the EFTA states call for close dialogue with the EU on this. So that is, in a nutshell, the problem. And I will try to demonstrate with some, these are just some examples of novel EU legislation that causes this problem for the EFTA states and for the Norway model. I will not go into details on any of these, but maybe I should just pick one to demonstrate what I'm talking about. Number the fifth on the list, the so-called CBAM, Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. According to the EU, that is EEA relevant. The legal basis is the environmental clause of the TFEU. The Norwegian government for a long time said, no, this is really about trade and goods coming in from third countries and should not be considered EEA relevant. But after a long debate in Norway, we have concluded that it is probably EEA relevant. It has to be taken into the agreement if this agreement is to work. But as you can all see, that will have implications for imports into Norway from these third countries. The same is true for many of the other investments from third countries and so on. None of these legal acts have yet been implemented into the agreement. It's not clear whether the EU will agree that they should be integrated. It's very difficult to find a coherent approach to this. So the dilemma is basically, We could go for a step-by-step extension of the scope of the agreement. But if we don't, if we say no to all of these new legal acts, then there's no longer one common market, and then there is fragmentation within the EA internal market. If we opt for the former, where to draw the line? Difficult. And of course, that's only from a Norwegian perspective. Will the EU allow cherry picking? Difficult. And even if we do, will we get into trouble with other trading partners? And I will just give you one example with CBAM. We just negotiated a free trade agreement with India. And there's nothing in that free trade agreement about CBAM. And then a few months later, Norway decides that CBAM probably belongs in the EA agreement. Well, will India agree with that? This just demonstrates how these new legal acts creates problems for us. And if India challenged that before the court of before the VTO system, then Norway would probably have to defend that on our own. Maybe the EU would help us. We don't quite know. And then I don't have that much time left, so I should just jump to that. Then comes the VTO, the safeguard measures, because we're not in the customs union, but we're in the internal market. It's been the big issue in my country for the last months. The EU safeguards against Faroe alloys that was finally decided in November 2025. The Norwegian government and the Icelandic government lobbied at the highest level for months to be exempted. DJ Trade concluded that that's not possible under VTO law, because these safeguard measures have to be non-discriminatory. And as long as we're not in the customs union, then DJ Trade, the lawyers in DJ Trade, concluded that we could not be exempted. And in the end, we were not exempted. And now we fare new safeguards against, for instance, or in particular, aluminium. That would be a problem for us. EU lawyers might say, well, this is just the price to pay for not being in the customs union. But Norwegian authorities would say, yeah, but we're in the internal market, and the EA agreement protects against free movement of goods. How can you square free movement of goods with safeguard measures? So there is this conflict between the EA agreement and VTO law. That's perhaps one way assess it. It's complicated, but it's because I also already mentioned the metal industry is important. Lots of people work there. This was the biggest case before Christmas in Norway. And that's the reason why we are currently discussing this. Is it possible to accede to the customs union? Does it make sense? Is something we should try to do? First question, does EU law allow for it? Well, the answer is probably yes, since the EU already has let third countries into its customs union. But what are the pros and cons for Norway and the other and Iceland? I think it's clear that the scope, if this is something we should consider, the scope would have to be limited to the product coverage of the EA, and keep fish and agriculture out of it, because otherwise we might as well just become members of the European Union. Will the EU accept this? We don't know. But if the EU should accept such a more limited customs union, the pro is, of course, that this will put Norway on the inside of the EU defense wall in geopolitical challenging. Right. So that's why we are discussing this at all. The problem is that, well, first of all, it will be further expansion of the democratic deficit in the Norway model, because then we would have to follow EU common commercial policy, that would, of course, be a political problem. From a legal perspective, it would probably entail that all of the existing free trade agreements we have with third countries would have to be renegotiated. That might be a nightmare for the Foreign Office. It's possible, but it's not something you really want to do, and perhaps particularly not in today's political climate. And there will be little left of the EFTA camp if we do this. I think the question we are struggling with at the moment is, it has been possible for us to remain halfway in and halfway out for 30 years. Is that possible anymore? And I think it's important that's often overlooked in Norway. From the EU perspective, this is quite important too. Norway really wants to be on the inside. We don't want to join the customs union, but we want to be on the inside when it comes to safeguards and so on. How much can, will, should the EU rely on non-members in its strive for strategic autonomy? That's a really interesting and quite difficult question. And it affects the UK too. If you become completely dependent on Norwegian steel or aluminium or whatever, then what when it comes to strategic autonomy? I think my time is up. I have one final slide, just to because some of you may ask, well, what about membership as the alternative? So I think it's important to know this is the most recent opinion poll in polls in Norway, just to demonstrate where we are in this Eurosceptic country. So the red line is the no camp, and the blue line is the yes camp. It's been fairly stable. You can see a certain Trump effect, March 25. But even the Trump effect is not even close to sort of closing the gap. And you will see it grows again when things feel more stable. So this is the political situation that the Norwegian politicians find themselves in. And perhaps even more, perhaps, at least I think it's interesting, if you break this down, you will see that it's the youth who are most skeptical to joining the European Union. In my age group, 40 to 49, there is actually a very small margin in favor of joining, but it's the youth, which is really interesting. I haven't really seen any good analysis why this is so, but I fear that some of them get a lot of news from social media where you have this doom and gloom picture of the European Union. It's a sinking project and everything is wrong with Europe. And then why should we join? But I think it's interesting for lawyers to have this context. And final slide, when it comes to the EA, the status quo, do you want us to stay in the EA? Absolutely. Massive majority, always been popular. So there's no appetite for Brexit. There's no appetite for leaving the internal market. So we're stuck in this very peculiar middle situation. We want to be in the internal market. It's really important for economy, free movement. We want free movement. We have no problem with free movement. We really want to be in the internal market. We don't want to join, and we want everything to work as it has done for 30 years. And then the world is changing, and what to do about that? So if I'm, you know, this is the dream scenario for Norway is to be member without voting rights. we want to be in there, but we won't be formally recognized as us. That's just a, don't quote me on that. Anyway, thanks for the attention.